Welcome to The Art of the Impossible, a podcast for the design and manufacturing industry that explores how you can leverage technology, processes, and people to make the impossible possible. I'm Asif Mogul, Senior Industry Manager at Autodesk, and each week I'll be joined by two experts from the design and manufacturing world to discuss their perspectives on the challenges our industry faces and share what they're doing to overcome them. From smart products, mass customization, digitization, supply chain resilience, and the convergence of once diverse industries, this podcast is for anyone that runs a design and manufacturing business who's interested in making things possible. You can subscribe by following us on Apple, Spotify, or via your favorite platform. Okay, welcome to series two of our podcast, The Art of the Impossible. My name is Asif Mogul. I'm the Senior Design and Manufacturing Market Development Lead in the company. And today, we're going to kick off Series 2 with a fantastic conversation around extended realities and the impact that this exciting technology has, both in terms of two of our customers and our guests today, and also how the potential it might offer to anyone out there in the general design and manufacturing industry. So to help me explore that discussion, I'd like to welcome our two guests for today, Craig Bunyan, who's the Associate Director and Creative Technology Lead at Seymour Powell, and also Brendan Mullins, an architect at Stantec, a design and architecture firm in Los Angeles. So we've got an international feel to episode one of series two. So welcome to you both.
Hi, Asif. Thanks very much. Thanks.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Pleasure. So perhaps we could start just by getting you to kind of just briefly introduce your organization and kind of your role in the context of that organization. So Brendan, could we start with you, please?
Sure. So Stantec is a large multidisciplinary firm. We have offices all over the world at this point. Our services range from engineering, architecture, project management. Our particular office in Los Angeles is mostly entertainment, transportation, and large civic museum projects.
Right, it sounds very broad and diverse. Thank you, Brendan. Craig, if I could ask you to do the same, please.
Yeah, sure. So Seymour Powell, we describe ourselves as a strategic design and innovation consultancy. We are global. We've got some offices dotted around the globe. I myself sit at the top of the crypt technology team, and I'm based in Scotland, which is currently where I'm talking to you from. We've been around for a long time. We're coming up on 37 years, I think, and we have a kind of massive bandwidth of things that we get involved with. So everything from consumer electronics to FMCG packaging to transportation and everything in between. And my team are involved in all of that, but we also go after and prosecute our own specific work, which generally sort of exists in the sweet spot between digital and physical experiences.
Great, thank you. So isn't it interesting? We've got two companies who on the face of it are so almost at the opposite ends of the spectrum, but there's some similarities already showing up between what you do. And then one of those similarities I think we're going to discuss today is the kind of use of something called XR, extended reality. So the industry, our industry, is full of buzzwords and jargon, and maybe VR is probably known pretty well. But I'm just curious in terms of XR. It feels like a potentially new technology. Maybe I'm going to ask you this, Craig, first. What exactly is extended reality, and how do you think it differs from virtual reality?
Well, I guess it's a good question, and one which we constantly are helping our clients understand. I mean, one of the things that I would say when asked generally is that it's a catch-all term that describes digital experiences, digital vision-based experiences, which literally extend the reality that you're observing or experiencing. But one thing which is frustrating, and I'm sure Brendan, you might agree, is that there is no clear sort of consensus on the use of these terms, and it's often one of the first barriers that you have to get across when you start talking to clients is ascertaining their current definition, the definition they've agreed on, and making sure that everyone's on the same page. I think that as we built our creative technology offer and continue to build on it, we're continually trying to refine and improve upon the way that we describe XR so that people understand the technology and the terms and the possibilities. And frankly, we've still not really arrived at a kind of verbal way of describing it that satisfies all scenarios. And the most sort of powerful thing that we've done over the years is build a series of case studies and examples that we can show people so that it doesn't require description.
That's interesting. So you're almost creating a way for them to experience what it is without the need of like using text to describe it. So,
exactly.
Brendan, were you about to say something? Sorry.
Yeah, I think just to jump off of the case study thing, that's huge. You know, we find clients will use the term virtual reality to explain pretty much any sort of walkthrough on a screen, whether it has a wearable or it doesn't. And that vague sense of using that word, it becomes confusing, especially when leadership might start adopting it and coming to technology staff and asking for something without a clear goal. And case studies have been everything for us. Being able to have them organized in a way that you can present them to clients either in project pursuit or during a project's duration is just the clearest way to explain something. I mean, the same reason we're using visuals in XR to help get our designs across is the same reason you want those visuals captured as case studies to share. It makes sure everybody's on the same page. And the great thing about case studies too is they really drive you to have different ones and pushes you to have different niche case studies for every type of scenario. So,
yeah, actually very interesting. So we're talking about case studies then. Maybe Brendan, I could ask you this. Do you have some examples of the, you know, kind of the real world applications of XR that either in your business or either anything you could talk about in terms of the work you do with clients?
Yeah, I've been involved in this space since, you know, the beginnings of the Oculus beta, and especially back then, people didn't know what it was. It really sounded like a sci-fi movie to most people. And these case studies were the only way for me to explain to anybody the power of this. And it was, case studies were also the best way for me to prove that it wasn't just a gimmick. There was a long stretch of time where I felt that overall leadership within the industry really thought this was a gimmick. At least the majority of folks did. And most people just didn't understand how to work it into a project the same way I think these days people have trouble understanding where computational design fits into a project. Unless you have real world case studies that have monetary value as well to add to the power of them in the convincing of a project manager, you struggle. So early on, our first case studies on a project, I was on the Cleveland Clinic Cancer Building, large healthcare. That was really the impetus for why XR made sense to me. We were doing healthcare mock-ups, you know, designing rooms out of cardboard where clients could move, you know, a patient table or a sink around in cardboard. And I was doing the drawing set for this. So this turns into a full-scale cardboard patient room for a hospital that they iterate on before we build the thing for real. And as the Oculus DK set is hitting the news, and I'm doing a drawing set to be built out of cardboard and then going home and maybe playing a video game, it just made perfect sense. Why do I have a BIM model that I can't go into like a video game and replace this cardboard strategy for mockups? We began doing Google Cardboard 360s, bring it into the Oculus. And what we eventually learned was it wasn't a replacement for anything. It was just one more tool in our tool bag, and it was a very powerful one. Now, going all the way up to where we're at now within the projects, especially my project, I'm working on the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art in Los Angeles. Nowadays, I think the reality of what our dreams is virtual reality technologies have finally come true. Things are wireless and things are multiplayer. Those two things have removed so many barriers for clients. They used to walk in to just a sea of wires, and then they had to put on a headset and essentially become blindfold in front of their colleagues. Between getting rid of the clutter and making this thing fit into our clean architectural office or a clean conference room, or not have wires over the top of drawings you're trying to view, and then adding in the fact that many people are in there together, I think a lot of the dreams are finally getting realized about what this technology is supposed to do for us.
It sounds incredibly cool. I just had one more additional question that just occurred to me as you were talking. You were saying that, back to the case studies comment, Brendan, is it often that you would show customers a specific case study? Let's say you did a case study of the cardboard mock-up to XR example that you just shared. And if I was your customer and you came to show me that, is it quite common for me to think, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do? Or would I then sort of take that as an inspiration and almost like innovate? Do you know what? Could I use that for, and then I would sort of say to you something completely different. Is there a sort of pattern emerging there that it's almost exactly the same case study that you would end up doing with someone else, or does it lead to even more innovations?
We always strive to find a new innovation. We don't want to keep giving everybody the same thing. But especially early on, people asked for whatever we showed them because they had never seen anything else. Most clients had never seen VR in the last, this has been going on now for 7 years or so that we've been really pitching this. Nowadays, we're starting to get clients who they've already worked with a firm who gave them VR. And they said, oh, firm X showed me this. We want to do this on this project. So clients, the same way BIM finally caught on and clients developed BIM standards, now clients are becoming a little more used to seeing VR. Not all of them, but some of them.
It's a case of like the awareness and maturity out there in the world is growing. And I think it just goes back to the importance of both of you said, the importance of case studies. We have to have something that we can wrap our heads around for us to think, I want to do exactly that, or can I add on to that? And that's sort of almost incrementally innovating. So yeah, thank you. So Craig, coming back to you, how is something like XR reshaped the way that the sort of the product development, the design process has worked? It sounds like it has had tremendous or potentially tremendous impacts, but can you give us some examples in how it's reshaped the way you work?
Sure. I mean, I guess there's a lot of common ground with what Brendan was saying and our experiences. I mean, I guess where we might be slightly differentiated is that we also now develop and deliver XR experiences as one of our services.
So almost like a product?
Literally,
Okay.
Which is quite a big shift for our company. So yeah, we could talk about that in a minute. But to go back to your question about how it's sort of changed the way we operate, similar to Brendan, DK1, DK2, we started to get really sort of pay attention and became interested in virtual reality specifically. And I remember sort of using it in very early on in some real projects that we were doing. Again, like Brendan, as another sort of force multiplier communication tool, and I think that was and has always been the sort of the starting point for our adoption of technology like that in our design practice. It's a successful designer lives and dies in their ability to communicate ideas and to communicate ideas in a way that diminishes or at least controls the interpretation of your audience. So sort of off the cuff interpretations driving new innovation directions is great when you're working with colleagues, but it can also be a real problem if you're talking to a non-design literate or non-visual literate person and they don't really get what you're saying. So VR for us was a way to cement that sort of communication quality, and very quickly we realized there was an opportunity there. And I think that where the sort of the dime dropped or the kind of light bulb moment for us happened was when we first started playing with, I think at the time it would be one of the Google Paint products, and immediately realized that actually we could be designing in this space. And we started shopping, literally looking for an off-the-shelf product that would give us a three-dimensional drawing and design package that we could design in VR using. And there was literally nothing on the market. So very quickly, we assembled a team and began building something for ourselves, which ended up turning into our RealityWorks sort of internal design tool. And it was a very selfish project. It was for us, for our team. We had no intentions of exposing it to anyone. We weren't thinking of turning it into a saleable product. But by the very nature of the fact that we were using it, clients became exposed to it, and it became apparent, as you say, Brendan, we showed them it, and they started asking us for it. Can we use this? Can we have this as part of our project? And I think that probably was the starting point for why VR became the backbone of the Virgin Galactic work that we did recently. And the way that changed how we approached that project was, in my opinion, extremely significant. So we've had a long-term relationship with Virgin Galactic, going back almost sort of 13, 14 years now. But the latest tranche of work that we did, which was bringing the interior to sort of reality, it very quickly became apparent that because of the geographical spread of the teams involved and the stakeholders and the expedited timeframe, that it was going to be extremely difficult to deliver that project at the level that we needed to be in the timescale we had, without either us essentially decamping to the spaceship company in Mojave or coming up with another solution, which is what we did, which is essentially we we built in VR as the backbone of the project. So it began with that RealityWorks, essentially blank canvas sketching tool, where we could bring in hardpoint data from their engineers and start playing with volumes and forms and figuring out how things worked. And the tool set evolved at pace with the design evolution. So very quickly, we were looking at surfacing tools inside that space, which then became color material trim evaluation tools, lighting evaluation. And then finally, we were helping their media team figure out where their cameras would go and what types of camera they could fit into the ship to get the best edits, all with the express purpose of expediting decision making. And if you like, you know, holding decision makers' feet to the fire to have them make those decisions. And it gave us the ability to remove some of those iterative loops that take time. So instead of delivering a presentation and then waiting for that presentation to be digested and then receiving feedback, it was like, okay, you don't like that blue. Let me shift this blue by 3 degrees to the right. Is it this blue? And we could have those decisions made in real time, you know, collaboratively, all in VR. And in the end, we were meeting inside the ship on almost a daily basis with the stakeholders and pushing things around. And it became sort of vital to the process for us.
It sounds very much like that this, you moved away from that sort of linear, let's do the kind of follow a straight line from a product development process to more of this kind of like agile. It's just like, just get stuff done. You could really focus on what you needed to do. I've got to say, if somebody invited me to go and camp out on a spaceship site for a month, I probably would say yes and go, because being a total space geek. So now you also mentioned something really interesting there, Craig. And Brendan, I want to sort of come to you on this, is that, you know, we talk to lots of customers all the time, and like many of the people who run these businesses, sort of like managing director kind of personas, I guess very few people wake up in the morning and think, I need to invest in an XR or a VR solution. There normally is a problem that they want to solve and an outcome they want to achieve. And then this becomes the kind of answer to it. And I think, Craig, you touched on a few of those. But Brendan, what are some of the sort of problems or outcomes that your clients and customers want to solve, of which, you know, VR or XR is part of the solution?
Well, yeah, we find that the clients don't, exactly like you say, they don't always know what they want at first. And that's, again, I keep going back to these case studies, but typically we will show them different flavors. And even if a client is not interested in VR at first, we will provide it in our base services, you know, at a smaller scale, and implement it throughout the project, keep giving them, you know, quote unquote appetizer as the project's going on. And, you know, it may start with some 360 Google Cardboard renderings. We'll have a lot of, you know, 3D walkthroughs on the computer in real-time environments. And we'll usually give them at least one or two chances to wear a wearable VR headset, regardless of whether they really ask for it. We will bring it into a meeting and see. It pretty much always works. The minute a client who hasn't used VR and is skeptical goes in and sees their project in three dimensions at scale, the power of it is instant. I mean, the technology really sells itself, assuming you have the technology working. I think there's a whole discussion about making sure that your hardware and software works, because if you show up to a skeptic with something that's either got it's running bad frame rates and making them sick, or things aren't working and you're playing with wires, it just adds to skepticism. So it's really about selling them throughout the project, getting them up to speed, and it always tends to sell itself. And these days, especially, we're trying to do a whole life cycle of putting XR in projects. So really trying to say, well, we go into construction administration, we continue to find value in XR from the day concept design starts, like Craig's saying, to the day that this building is open. And again, I think the technology really sells itself.
Yeah. And are there some specific themes where do people come to you and say, oh man, Brendan, I've got a real problem with X, or my big problem is communication, or my projects are taking too long. And there's this sort of sense of a problem that they're trying to solve. Are there some common themes in terms of problems your customers or your clients, tell you about, of which VR, XR is some of or all of a part of the solution? Could you share some examples on that?
Sure. So maybe jumping back to the healthcare mock-up scenario. So mocking up healthcare rooms is a very common practice in the industry. They start with usually making them out of cardboard. Then they'll make what's called a quote-unquote in-place mock-up. They're essentially building the room as it will really be fully finished architecturally. And they're just building one of them before the building's done, so they can do one last round of iteration before they make 400 patient rooms or whatever the scenario is. And this works the same with hospitality and hotels and many other industries. This process is expensive. I mean, the cardboard side of it isn't too expensive, but you start getting to building in-place operation rooms. It's obviously an expensive prospect. And what we find is the clients have to decide which rooms they really want to mock up. I mean, let's say there's many rooms that they're going to make many of, but they can only afford to mock up maybe their most important. One gap that VR has filled is now we can mock everything up digitally at a fraction of the cost. So if you can't afford to mock up your operation rooms, especially because they have a lot of expensive equipment, they're larger than a patient room, et cetera, no problem. We can do this digitally. We also find recently when we're doing more sculptural projects, like the project I'm on, the Lucas Museum, where there's no straight lines, 2D drawings don't really tell you any of the story in layman's terms. People cannot understand a sculptural building if you just show them a floor plan, because no matter where we cut the section on our project, it's different. 2D renderings begin to suffer the same fate, which is to say the views are so dynamic with sculptural ceilings and sculptural walls that renderings, you need many of them to explain a space. Well, we begin seeing a pattern here. It's an obvious choice. Virtual reality and XR is the obvious choice to explain complex forms to somebody because they can see it with their own eyes and the brain is processing millions of times the information that we can give out in words or in a 2D rendering. So especially with these three-dimensional forms, we've found a huge power. And we've gone so far as when we're explaining it to people when we're trying to get a permit, if we're going to local jurisdictions and trying to explain a complex form and how, and they're trying to figure out something basic, like where does a fire alarm device go on a wild sculptural form? It's very hard to explain that to someone in 2D. Even though they need to stamp those 2D drawings, they might do so without the confidence they wish they had, or they might play more hardball because they're not confident with what they're seeing. So they're staying conservative because they're trying to cover something. So being able to take people who can't process a 2D drawing like an architect and take them into this space just makes everything go faster and adds a huge level of confidence. People know what they're getting.
Great. No, that's a really great example. So thank you. So let's kind of shift gears into kind of the second phase of our conversation, which is about, sort of staying with benefits, is that we've heard some great examples of how VR, XR, and these kind of these technologies are impacting some of the worlds of your customers and your clients. What impact has this kind of technology had on your actual organization? Craig, how has the availability of this tech changed the business at Seymour Powell?
There's been a bit of an organic growth and journey that we've gone on. As I say, our start point was a very selfish one. We were interested in the tools because we thought it would help our business. And I remember when we first began exposing clients to some of this tech, as Brendan said, you were, you know, got on a couple of planes with, you know, literally hundreds of pounds worth of equipment. And trying to lug that through customs and set up lighthouses in clients' rooms. And it completely destroyed the impact of what was often a very profound experience for clients if you could get them in there. But the real big game changer for us was when we were able to crack our first multiplayer experience. So collaboration, really, I think is the big deal. Because that suddenly changed and shifted the dynamic of those experiences away from purely demonstrative to one that was truly collaborative and where we could actually do work inside the space. And that was a big deal for us. I mean, I think that, Brendan, you definitely touched on that there. One of the sort of powers of virtual reality specifically is your ability to understand and appreciate space and form. Maybe that's because you've got a sense of self in that space. But the extension of that, once you're in a space with someone else, and that sense of literally being transported and going on a journey means that firstly you have their undivided attention because they're literally inside that space with you. They can't see their emails, they can't see their phone. So that's really valuable in today's world. But instead of, you know, using remote technology, which has generally been designed for transactional communications, so for businesses to seal the deal, you're in a space around the work, so, you know, around the campfire, and it completely changes the dynamic of that kind of that working experience. And from an operational perspective, that's really powerful, and it's allowed us to change the way that we design, because we can incorporate and build in these types of sessions which aren't kind of disruptive and help us on a much more regular basis. But it's also allowed us to develop some, as I say, some products that we can sell to clients. So the conclusion of the Virgin story was that we had essentially convinced the skeptics within the company that VR was a legitimate way of demonstrating this fantastic product experience. And when the pandemic hit and the plans for revealing the cabin interior to the world were essentially destroyed, we were able to pivot and use VR to deliver an experience which had to be 5-star and had to be similar to the champagne reception they were going to get at Spaceport America, but virtually and in their own homes. And in order for that to happen, collaboration was essential, because we had to put these VIP customers and world's press in the space with the key stakeholders and with the designers that had made those decisions, so that they could have the same feeling of involvement and buy-in as if they were in the conference space at Spaceport, but also the consistency of experience. So we could send them a headset that we knew would work out the box, that they didn't need to be experts to set up, and everyone would get that same consistent experience, didn't rely on the power of their laptop or how good their Wi-Fi was, you know.
So Brendan, I can't help imagining that, you know, if an organization starts to embrace technology for its clients and even itself in the way that Craig described, it's going to have an impact on your people, the culture of the organization. Have you seen like a cultural change inside your organization? And could you describe what that change looks like?
Yeah, definitely. I think this is actually a very interesting point, because I think Craig and I sound like we may differ in how we've helped push colleagues in this technology. My day-to-day is as an architect. I am doing virtual reality experiences in between doing construction administration and solving construction problems. So my day-to-day is dynamic and complex, and it's also just busy. And what we found early on with virtual reality is it was requiring us to be video game developers. I mean, I'm sure Craig remembers, you were forced to open up Unity, a software I never intended on opening up for any reason. I'm an architect on a day-to-day. And I was essentially developing video games so that we could get our models into virtual reality. That was just the workflow back then. And I saw just a huge problem with that. We have clients with very strict budgets. They don't have tens of thousands of dollars for video game development. And it was difficult to justify it with an overhead too at times, just because of the sheer amount of labor and skill sets you essentially had to hire to do it. And I decided very early on, at least personally, that my idea was I want plug and play solutions built right into the platforms that architects are already using. I want architects to be able to do this at the click of a button, because if they're on a deadline where they're having to churn out hundreds of drawings and details in between pumping out a rendering for their principal to take, virtual reality, if it takes too much time, is just going to get left behind, because there's an immediate need that has to get met. And we've made sure that the software platforms we're promoting, at least internally, are plug and play, click a button. Any architect can do this. And that way, I think the benefit of it has been in the cultural change that it's created, is if you can just get people's feet wet, you know, if you can just have a young architect with a project manager or principal above them who have never used VR, and you're able to give them a cheap headset and a one-click solution to get into VR, that means this young person can give a proof of concept to their leadership for very little time, maybe an hour or two after work, just a quick session, learn something, and then you have a budget that can be very low. You can get into VR for under $100, or you can get into VR particularly under 1,000, which is a nice, easy number for any project of any size to justify. And being able to democratize it at that level and make it that easy to do, that's what's really made it spread. People don't have to come with, I want the software to do this, this, and this. It's like, why don't you just click this button, put this headset on with your principal, and the power is in the proof, right? You can't miss it. It's going to work and it's going to sell. So that's been the cultural change as we push those kind of technologies, easy things. We write up instructionals. We hand out case studies, well documented, so anybody can do a quick read, say, I want to do that. What's it take? I need this, and one-click solutions. So it has transformed us.
It sounds like a great example of something that we talk about, digital transformation. And I guess, Brendan, correct me if I'm wrong, do you think it's made your the people that you employ a little bit more courageous in the kind of like, I'm now more open-minded to try new things, things that I once thought were so specialist. But you know what? I think you said get their feet wet. Once somebody's got their feet wet, do you think they're likely to sort of jump in the water a bit more willingly next time? Have you seen that effect?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it just excites folks. And I think that another thing I saw on an unrelated or a similar topic was computational design. You have kids coming out of college and entering our firm. If leadership doesn't know what computational design is, usually the new hires just won't do it, right? Unless they're told to do it, they won't do it. And the same goes for visualization. You have folks coming out with crazy visualization skills out of college, but if they're not told to flex them, they typically won't unless they're asked to give an assignment, right? You're timid as a young employee. Unless you have a principal who pushes it, they might just start learning how to draw details and do it for 2 years, right, without really flexing those muscles. So I think visualization is just a great way for everybody to start. It's such a universal language within the firm. You start getting folks using advanced technology. Eventually, you start thinking, it just opens people's minds. How do we bring computational design into this virtual world? How do we collaborate remotely, as Craig's implying, multiplayer environments? It opens a door, and that's what we love about those one-click solutions. It's like people's minds just open. Principals see the power, and now they're asking for something. Now they're asking for, when they don't even know what VR is, they said, what if VR could do this? Now I can use it.
It sounds like that upward spiral. Sorry, Craig, please.
It's fascinating how kind of similar some of the experiences we've been having inside our teams as well. I mean, in particular, one of the big issues that we've grappled with over the past 5 or so years is one of education. And that's to say educating the rest of our company on what our small team is capable of. And it's been remiss of us to not have the tools to explain that effectively until we've built these case studies, back to the case study story. But your experience, Brendan, we've now got a situation where for visualization purposes, really the basic VR hopefully isn't falling on the shoulders of our team anymore. We're sort of empowering and democratizing the entryway into that system at the designer's level so they can do it themselves. And it's freeing us up to go off and do the more sort of specific experiential and building more sort of complex functionality. And the one big cultural shift that has inspired and we're starting to implement is a shift towards a poly-first CAD workflow. And that's something that's going to take a long time for us. You know, we're a company with a long legacy of CAD use, and CAD will never disappear from our day-to-day. But there are many projects now where we look at it objectively, there's no reason that it shouldn't begin essentially in the same way as a game development project would work. You know, that explains why, you know, we've been hiring from games industry for the last few years as well. We've got game devs as part of our team. And I think that what we're trying to do now is build the confidence amongst the wider company to adopt those workflows with the knowledge that it's not going to damage, it's only going to improve the design outcomes.
Thank you, Craig. So one of the outcomes that we start hearing much more now about is around sustainability, our impact as a species on the planet. And there's a stat that I've forgotten the source of it, but apparently 80% of a product's environmental impact is incurred in the design phase. And so it strikes me that as we're iterating, however we do it, making good choices and good decisions in the design phase when we're still all virtual could be a great way to reduce our sort of physical impact on the planet. Do you think things like VR, XR definitely have a kind of a role to play in driving greater sustainability? Craig, from your point of view?
Without a shadow of a doubt. I think that being a designer is intrinsically tied to being responsible, being socially responsible and ethically responsible. Seymour Powell's mission statement is about making things better, better for people, better for business, and better for the environment, better for the world. And I think that the XR is a fantastic lever to allow us to maximize on those promises and those goals. So a good example of this would be the work that we've done with Historic Environment Scotland. They're a government-owned, part charity-run organization who are responsible for managing a number of built heritage sites in Scotland. And they're looking at a green recovery after Scotland and everything that encapsulates. And we're trying to help them understand how XR can be part of that. And we're helping them to build an operational tool, essentially to reduce their need to travel to the sites that they manage whenever there's a problem. And we're putting together a system that will allow them to take advantage of the very highly detailed 3D scan data that they have of these sites that they do as part of their cataloging workflow. The tool that we're building allows them to meet with key stakeholders, with architects, with the media, with stonemasons, with the health and safety inspectorate, etc., so that they can pre-plan and essentially figure out 90% of a job before they ever have to set foot on the site. And I think that's a very clear example of XR reducing the carbon footprint, reducing the environmental impact of an organization, and one which we're very proud to be part of.
And Brendan, from your point of view, if you think about sort of the design of an energy efficient building or a hospital space or any kind of like physical space, what role does things like VR and XR play in highly efficient building design or better building designs? Do you have any examples of that?
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting question. Typically, this has been a communication and iteration tool, but it does make things more efficient. I mean, for instance, if I jump back to the role of just of being at a human scale, buildings can be created too large. Efficiencies can be missed. And users are ultimately some of the best drivers of efficiency, right? They see where a thing could be better placed, especially when we're talking about hospitality and healthcare. When we're able to put healthcare practitioners into VR, it makes just more efficient buildings. It means that things are always within the proper reach. Things can be tighter, smaller. We can create smaller floor plates. We can make sure travel distances become maximized because they're able to actually walk it before construction, right? We might separate rooms too far apart, create too large of a floor plate. If they can walk this thing in virtual reality, they can optimize the design with us, and they can build on the skills that we have. So, you know, we as architects have a certain ability to make the most efficient and beautiful project. But once you have the client who's, you know, again, it's been democratized, they're seeing what we're seeing. There is no longer a barrier of a piece of paper in 2D. They're working with us. Things get tighter. Things get more efficient.
Great, thank you. So we switched to the last sort of phase of our conversation, which is a little bit about possibilities and then advice. So in a while, I'm going to sort of come to you and sort of ask you what advice you would give to someone else who's thinking about getting their feet wet. Let's use Brendan's phrase here, getting their feet wet in the world of VR. But before we get to that, we've been talking about from a product development consulting organization's point of view and from an architect's point of view, the design and manufacturing industry is massively diverse. There's industrial machinery companies, there's automotive, there's aero defense. Do you feel that things like XR, VR have an equal role to play in those industries? Craig, let's come to you first.
Absolutely they do, but that's only because, as you know, Brendan rightly said at the beginning of the podcast, they're just another tool set. They're one which is happens to be particularly powerful at communication and delivering understanding. And I think that for that very reason, they will become and are becoming inextricably linked with creativity and development. Anything that can help a designer communicate an idea, whether that be, as you say, in a sort of defense company's role or a sort of transportation setting, is going to be sort of snapped up and used heavily. But more widely, any company that can implement a system or mechanism that can help them with their communication and understanding is going to be beneficial for their business. So yes, I think it's inevitable that this type of technology will become more widespread and more commonly used. And also companies are, you know, we're certainly seeing this in terms of the business inquiries that are arriving on our doorstep. Companies are starting to think about how they exist and how they present themselves in that space. And companies which have previously no real synthetic or digital footprint. So I think that's a real bellwether for change that's happening.
Brendan, do you think you just have to be a larger organization to be able to take advantage of this type of technology? Or what if I was a small, use a very sort of a British metal bashing company based in a certain part of the UK and maybe had 50 to 100 people? Is it still applicable that I could get some value? Because you talked about lower costs of entry, like lower barriers to entry, like $100 to $1,000. Is this technology still applicable and therefore of value to that type of organization?
Yeah, I mean, dealing with architecture teams, architects can be frugal and budgets can be tight. And so there's no doubt. I mean, when I first got into this space, Stantec is great in that we have a very large research and development fund. This started where they were able to put up money to me and a small team where we could develop this technology out for Stantec. The advantage of that has been that we've had budget to document. So we've been putting out reports. They've turned into essentially a small book that's highly visual that explains all the different flavors of VR you can do. And dealing with tight budgets, we start at like $40. Essentially, a Google Cardboard and a 360 rendering costs nearly nothing. And the same goes for when we're trying to sell it to a client. We can offer very affordable services. For instance, right now in construction administration, during COVID, we're doing site walks. We have an international team. So we have designers all around the country and sometimes around the world. Let's pick a particular consultant, an acoustician, somebody doing acoustics. They might only have budget to visit our site twice. But we're talking about a facility, a museum and theaters. I mean, it's obviously important that this thing is done right. Well, for the cost of a $450 360-degree GoPro, if I'm recording myself walking through the site every time on a 360-degree GoPro, now everybody on our team can go on that site walk with me anytime they want, because they can just go on Google Cardboard, on YouTube, and they can look around, and it's as if they walked the same footsteps I did. And on top of that, it's memorializing the construction process before things get covered up. Now we can almost reverse time and look in any direction we want for a site walk. That's a 450-degree barrier. I mean, it's almost nothing. And Revit has built-in 360-degree rendering functions that I don't even think everybody knows about. And it's like, you pretty much already pay for it. You just have to click the button. And it literally couldn't be easier these days and couldn't be more affordable. I mean, it's reached a point that easily single family architects doing kitchen remodels can put this into their workflow. It all is based on the assets. If you have a 3D model, you can do this. It's pretty much the only barrier at this point. You just have to have a 3D asset.
That sounds like such a relatively low barrier to entry. So it does sound like everyone from a kind of a, as you say, single person consultancy to, you know, mid or even large size organizations, there's a flavor of this that they could apply into the business. So I'd like you to imagine that every single design and manufacturing company, and maybe even every single architect on the planet is listening to the both of you. And they're all thinking of implementing some form of VR or XR. Starting with you, Craig, what advice would you give them? What's the first step someone should take if they've got zero to little experience of this? What's the first thing you would advise that person to do? And Brendan, I'll come to you and ask you the same question.
Well, I guess as a business, our standpoint is always about making things better. And that would hold true in this question as well. Anyone that's looking to implement any new technology needs to look at why they're doing that. And it absolutely deserves that audit process. It definitely shouldn't be a journey that someone goes on just because they feel like they need to keep up. Is it going to improve either your business outcomes or your customers' outcomes? Aside from that, if it has been identified that this is going to, you know, improve your business, then in terms of adjusting or optimizing your organization to make the transition to or the adoption of the technology easier, I think that the only barrier to creating XR experiences is being able to generate 3D content, whether that's at the very low end 360 footage, as Brendan was describing, or highly detailed game optimized representations of a product or space. That's really the area of your business and workflow that you need to look at first. Essentially, a VR headset is just a monitor that you wear on your face. It shouldn't be thought of as anything other than that. So the power and efficacy of any of these XR experiences, whether it be via a headset or monitor, augmented reality, is the quality and the efficacy of those assets. And you need to be in a position to generate those in a cost-effective manner, which is why, as a business, we're looking at moving away from a defaulting to CAD and moving to building game-ready assets from the beginning of a project, so that there's no pain point to say, right, well, we now want to jump into VR and we want to create this fantastic experience that we can sell to the customer or whatever. We need to start again and remodel everything. hey, we've already got all these fantastic assets. They're incredibly flexible and we can do all this with it. So, you know, if you're, to use your example, Asif, if you're a metal bashing company in the Midlands, maybe the pipeline to getting 3D assets, one of the sort of new and easy to use 3D scanning applications that you can implement. That's really the main technological barrier. But as I say, I think that the first thing that you should do is understand what it is you're trying to achieve and why you want to do something.
Start with the why. Simon Sinek would be very, very thrilled at your answer there. So, Brendan, maybe the same question to you. If you had to advise the entire industry on, and they're all saying, I've got no idea where to start, what would your recommendation be? Where's the literally the first place to start to dip your toe in that water of VR, XR?
On an advanced level, I think I would piggyback off of Craig, but at a simple level, like you're saying, what's the first thing I would click or the first thing I would do? I mean, my vision of VR in the future is essentially where the Oculus Quest has gone, a wireless self-contained computer. Well, where I really want it to go is I want these phones to be that. I see a future where the phone is powerful enough to replace the headset in the computer entirely, and I think we're going to get there. But the phone is already very powerful. 360-degree movies and 360-degree renderings are so simple to host. They're hosted free on YouTube or free on a photo hosting website. So if you have an as-built project, the first thing you can do is take a 360-degree photo, either with a free app or a very affordable camera. If you have a 3D model, you're probably in Revit or a similar software. The same thing goes. Revit already has it built in. There's softwares for less than $1,000 that you can churn out 360-degree renderings easily. And most of these firms, design firms, have a Photoshop ability. We have workflows where we're showing you how to Photoshop a 360-degree rendering. Those are skills your young staff probably already have, some basic Photoshopping skills. So to Craig's point, if you have a 3D model, you're pretty much 90% of the way there. The entry after that is simple. And it can all be done with nothing more than your phone and an affordable piece of software or a software you already have and you just don't even understand that it has the power to churn this out for you.
I love that. Love both of those answers. So we've pretty much come to the end of the conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Now, what I've got to do is try and sort of summarize into a few key bullet points, all the sort of pearls of wisdom that you've both shared with me. So you can give me feedback on whether you think I've got this right. Apologies if I've completely missed the mark. But from what I've learned from this discussion, technologies like VR, XR, or anything, they're just a tool. They're just a tool to achieve an outcome. So this is something that we should think about as another tool set. And I heard that it's a tool set that's particularly powerful at removing barriers, allowing your client, whether it's an internal or an external client, to really experience your intent fully. So that as an outcome, you end up with a better product, whether it's a building or a Virgin Galactic spaceship or a mobile phone or a headset, you can develop a much better product in less time and less risk, meaning there's a very strong business case for it. It seems that the way to get your toes in the water, it feels like it really does and should start with leadership. Brendan, you talked about, well, unless leadership is kind of saying, hey, guys and girls, look at all this cool stuff out there. Why don't we give this a go? It may never happen. Because people might just default to doing the same things. And what leadership needs to do is really think about the why, the outcomes. Why are we doing this? Is it going to make our business better, or is it going to make our relationship with customers better, or is it both? And perhaps case studies, it just reinforces the point that you both made right at the beginning of this conversation, is case studies are king. So try and get your hands on as many case studies to almost, if I might say something really corny, help you experience the art of the possible. I know this is the art of the impossible, but experience the art of the possible. And to really take that further forward, maybe you should just dip your toes in the water and give it a go. Maybe some of the skills that you need, some of the tech is already in your staff base with, Brendan, as you said, your younger generation with things like mobile phones and very, very low cost, low entry pieces of technology and software, sometimes or even sort of shareware or freeware. And you maybe start with something simple, give it a go, and maybe sort of go from there. So I kind of think that's what I've learned from this conversation today. Would you both agree? Do you think I've captured that right? Have I missed anything?
Yeah, I mean, I the one thing I would maybe add on top of that, on top of the leadership statement, is just leadership needs to empower. It's all about empowering those young staff.
Empowering, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, VR, especially within Stantec, has been bottom up. and XR has been bottom up. And I think that's really the best way to do it, because the young staff are already the ones that have a video game at home, understand how to use Photoshop, 3D model. All you have to do is empower them and just say, hey, can you give me an example of this? And odds are, if they're savvy, they're going to be able to do it quickly. So empower that young staff to prove to you what it can do.
Okay. Understand the why and then empower your staff. Great. Craig, how did I score in terms of my summary of what you both said?
Yeah, I think you were pretty spot on. I mean, the evolution of this tech sector is almost terrifying how quickly it's moving. And the sort of ubiquity of three-dimensional augmentation in our daily lives is coming, and it's coming quickly. Whether that be delivered through new pieces of hardware or just a general mass adoption of businesses and experiences using it as a way of dealing with customers, that ubiquity means that people are going to come to expect experiences that involve XR. And as an industry, we should be leading that from the front and making sure that it's making people's lives better.
So this is almost going to become table stakes at some point. Is it, you know, just, I suppose, deal with the fact that this is what people are going to expect as a norm?
Inevitably.
Yeah, you think about the firms who didn't adopt BIM and how painful it was, you know, for firms who got left behind in the BIM revolution. The same thing is happening right now. And so you don't want to get left behind.
That's a great way to bring this conversation to a close. So on behalf of myself, thank you, Craig.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Brendan.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
It's been a great discussion. And thank you for listening. And we'll tune in with you again on the next episode of The Art of the Impossible. So thanks and see you next time.